is now Professor Jim McNamara, Professor of Public Communication, and he's talking about engaging citizens through e-democracy. Jim.
Thank you. Good afternoon, all. In terms of human rights, the research that I'm going to talk about is not quite as dramatic as areas of famine and violence, but nevertheless, citizens' right to have a voice and participate in decision-making certainly has that connection. And somewhat coincidentally, one of the online consultation sites that we looked at in this research was the National Human Rights Online Consultation Initiative, so there's that linkage as well. Basically, this is an interim report from the first stage of a research study looking at the federal government, as many of you may know, has launched a series of trial online consultation sites to engage citizens in democracy, decision-making, hear their views, and so on. And for those who look at it, want to look at it theoretically, of course, the whole framing of that is you can be looking at it through Habermas's public sphere, even accepting that some people say that's a very normative and perhaps idealised view for deliberative democracy, not only deliberative democracy but republican and representative democracy also share concerns that citizens need a voice, democracy only functions well if there is adequate access and an opportunity, and in fact deliberative, representative and other forms of democracy all share a concern of the declining participation in politics and so forth. So in any of those theoretical framings, there seems to be a desirability. When you come to this subject of online consultation, it has many names, and just a little bit of backgrounding is there's language of e-government, e-democracy, e-citizenship, e-participation, and so on it goes. Just to try and contextualise it slightly, there is various uses of language worldwide, but when you look at UN literature and OECD and scholarly literature, e-government generally is referred to the delivery of online services, so your tax forms and applying for a visa online, information and services. And e-democracy and other terms have started to talk about this additional area of simply participation, citizens having a voice. In fact, there's cynicism about it at times. Before I go to that quote, one I like is one morning says, two Australian authors say, it's a new buzz phrase in the lexicon of the digital mythmakers. So there is some concern. But there is definitions such as the use of web technologies to engage citizens in debate, discussion, consultation, online voting. So we're differencing it from delivery of services. And that's certainly the term that the Department of Finance, I'm not privileging the term e-democracy over e-citizenship, that was the term that the Department of Finance and deregulation were using when they came to these trials. I'm not sort of going to go through the whole background, but I'm happy to make these notes available, but just really recapping a little bit of history is that the US is well advanced in this area and sort of started under the Clinton administration, although delivery of services was still their primary focus. But of course you'd all know how things have gained momentum under Obama. And we haven't put too much emphasis on Obama's campaign, only for two reasons. One, a very big part of it was fundraising, and that's kind of quite distinct. And secondly, there is this tendency to put too much emphasis onto the heat of an election campaign. What about after the heat has subsided and you look at the day-to-day? But nevertheless, there were some very interesting things, and we did interview some of the people in the background of Obama's campaign. Canada took an early lead, but has quietened down. The UK has got a very long history in not only services, and part of the reason I'm just showing this is you'll always see services were sort of the first initiative, and then it's latterly they start to think about using online for actual citizen engagement as opposed to just services. The latest iteration in the UK is directgov.uk, and some of you may know, just another interesting little warning of how these things are problematic at times. There is also a group called directionlessgovernment.uk, which is rather interesting to look at. New Zealand, if anyone wants to look into this area, New Zealand is quite noteworthy. We haven't studied it here, and my colleague who worked with me on this is sitting up the back, Vicky. We didn't look at New Zealand, but there's some very progressive things being done there. We particularly did look at the UK in terms of literature research, because some of you may know they've recently had a fairly major review called the Power of Information Review. They've published that report, it's available. And then they formed a Power of Information Task Force, chaired by Richard Allen, former MP. And that report has come out. And just as one example of the complexity of this issue, this report identified 3,000 government websites, that the central websites, and they were saying it's just unnavigable and that they couldn't see why there was perhaps 1,000 or less. In Australia, and I'm only talking federally, and again, I'm not going to talk to these things, but there's been a long history of back as far as 97, but again, very much looking at services. And then you'll start to see a little shift here, and I've just really wanted you to look at the headings. Future of e-government, still services. Checklist for online policy consultation. You'll suddenly see about 04, a shift in the focus, policy consultation. And then, of course, the election of the Rudd government made a big play of Kevin 07 and a real interest in these media, which sort of caught our attention. The Rudd government asked AGIMO, the central body, Australian Government Information Management Office, to prepare a paper. And in July 2008, the Minister, Lindsay Tanner, announced that they would launch online consultation trials in Australia. So what we did decided we'd have a look at these trials. The sort of research questions we were asking is, you know, why? What were their objectives? Why were they doing it? What were the platforms used? Why did they choose those platforms? And we looked at the Department of Broadband's Wichita blog, Department of Education, etc., had a teachers forum for an online consultation, and the Attorney General's decided to extend the face-to-face human rights consultation initiative into an online forum as well, and we wanted to look at those three. We did also extend it to include other spontaneous online consultation initiatives that were happening around there. I won't go through the methodology, but it was, even though we did capture some quantitative data about number of participants and posts, we're really interested in qualitative. Purpose of sampling, obviously, we were choosing them. To some extent, snowballing method, because when we found other sites that people referred us to, we went on and we used depth interviews. We interviewed, in the end, webmasters and policymakers and communication managers in 10 federal departments and agencies. We also went to interview some independent experts, in quotes, to get some critical views, and we looked at the international experiences to try and contrast those. I'll just quickly try and summarise 10 key findings that came out of it, and some I'll only mention very quickly. And the first, some of them are a little bit motherhood, you might sound this, but they're quite important. Planning. Planning is obviously key. It sounds like a cliche, but it was interesting because it's clear that you need to establish clear objectives and your intent. What there seems to be is a tendency to jump to the technology first and say, let's have a blog. And in fact, Minister Conroy announced in July that his department would have a blog, and in August and September the department was planning how they would do online consultation. Rather interesting, and you could argue that a blog was not the right forum for it. So there really needs to be things thought through, moderation, resources, privacy, evaluation, all of those things. And they say it needs to involve policy, IT and communication. Without policy there's no connection to the policy making process. Obviously IT are in there, but some of the sites run by IT people weren't too communicative either. Controversial issues can hijack, bit of a sensitive word, they hijack consultation. What happened was rather interesting is Minister Conroy's blog was announced only weeks after his very infamous announcement of internet filtering. And it wasn't meant to focus on internet filtering, but of course the entire blog was taken over by that discussion. Now, one perspective on that is that if you want to listen to citizens, you've got to let citizens say what they want to say. But the reason I use the word hijack is there is a question over whether certain interest groups get in there and hijack the debate and send multiple messages and really drive the issue. Are you really hearing a representative citizen's views? Or is it being hijacked by certain interest groups that might be getting in there to ginger up the debate? And of course, ABC Learning Centres collapsed just when Dewar was having its childcare centre discussion. And the Attorney General's site was also problematic in a number of ways, and it really got taken over by certain groups wanting to talk about the Bill of Rights, and they were trying to talk about other things. Just as one example, here's a Sydney Morning Herald piece saying that prominent bloggers have lashed the federal government over its first attempt, already hijacked by critics of the plans to censor the internet. So there was that reaction. But it's a difficult question, because if that's what people are concerned about, if they genuinely are concerned, of course, you've got to let them talk. talk about what they want to talk about, not necessarily the agenda of the government. Time frame, probably no need to talk about it, but public service time frame, ministerials, the way they process versus online, it's an interesting sort of clash there. There's a lack of guidelines in many cases, and AGIMO is sort of rushing to try and develop new guidelines, but a lot of the existing guidelines for handling citizen inquiries don't meet the Web 2 environment. Resources, big issue there, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but you've got to, it's all very good to open the site, which a lot of people were doing with goodwill and good intentions, but there was a lack of thought about how we're going to process. If this site is popular and we get thousands or millions of words of comment, what are we going to do with it? Nobody got additional staff to do this. And even more than that, didn't come out so much in the Australian interviews, I don't think, but talking to the UK people, a big issue found in the Power of Information Task Force was culture. There is a culture, whether we like it or not, within the public service that suggests that we may not necessarily want to open these processes up to more citizens. After all, there's a way of doing things. Also, to be fair to public servants, they need air cover. Often if they are encouraged to go online and talk to people and make statements, they put their foot in their mouth, say one little thing and the minister's unhappy, suddenly they are way outside of the public service guidelines. So there's an issue there with both culture and with the guidelines. Big one is design and navigation. It gets more technical, but there's really three things with this. First of all, at a macro level, a lot of the writers in this area talk about the citizens shouldn't have to understand the structure of government in order to participate. Meaning, you don't have to know which department something belongs in. And a lot of the websites are arranged that way. You have to go within a department, and if you don't know which department, you're floundering around. Things should be easy to find physically within the navigation, and secondly, we need to consider people with disabilities, and there was not a lot of evidence of that. I need to just put this up to remind me to say, and I'm sort of selectively picking on the human rights side, but if you wanted to look at human rights online consultation, where would you go? A lot of citizens, we think, would probably go to the Human Rights Commission. When you went to the Human Rights Commission, there was a link called Share Your Views, National Human Rights Online Consultation. You clicked it, and you went to an article by Father Frank Brennan in Open Forum, an independent think tank. And I thought, that's interesting. Right down the bottom of that was another link to Share Your Views, and that took you to a website. And when you got to that website, you clicked another thing to say Submit Your Views, and you went back to Open Forum. When you did your fifth or sixth click, you got to a form. Very friendly, isn't it? That's really, I don't know what you think, but is that inviting you to be a citizen and give your views? So there's still a culture of, we'll have online consultation, but we'll do this in the usual public service way and just put in your name and your address and all these details. And by the time you type 6,000 characters, you still hadn't had your say. That also leads to the issue of language. A residue of ministerial and online government consultation is there's a language. There's a very formal, structured way of writing submissions. And in the moderation, it was interesting. Of course, they've got to deal with issues like profanities and racist comments and so on. But if you said shit in most of these, you got kicked out. Let alone cartoons, spoofs, mashups. So I've written a lot on this in other papers that I've submitted, and one published in Media International Australia, and others have written about it. But if you trace democracy through its history, pamphleteers and cartoonists and folk songs, there's always been an ability for people to speak in their own language, in their own vernacular, and that needs to be brought to this debate. And at the moment, we haven't sort of grasped that kind of issue. You've really got to write like you're in a government submission, pretty much, let alone write in text talk, SMS, Twitter, etc. Another key issue, and I'll just quickly mention this, is should they all be government hosted, or should government, if it wants to consult with citizens, actually go to other places and listen? And Stephen Coleman talks about managed e-citizenship versus autonomous e-citizenship. Government is very concerned about privacy and control, and control is a very problematic word in Web 2, and often are hosting these things. And of course, government sites can be intimidating. And in marketing, there's a phrase, fish where the fish are. GetUp's one example. If there's a lot of people in GetUp, why not go there? And a great example in the UK is NetMums. The UK government wanted to talk to mothers about childhood health issues, so they set up a site. But there's an organisation called NetMums that has 500,000 women voluntarily involved and regularly involved. surely, and the Power of Information Task Force recommended that really if the government was serious, it would go and listen to the people in Netmums and take advice there. And probably you need a combination of both, realistically, we thought. Very quickly, ninth finding was sense-making tools. It's all very good to have all of this, and if you do get the participation, but basically there are issues, and I won't go through the table, but monitoring, responding, categorising, sorting, and making sense of all of this information. And as many of you know, a blog is not the easiest way to make sense of something when you've had 5,000 comments, because it's just linear. And there's some interesting work being done at MIT in the thing they call the Deliberatorium, which is an experiment which is really worth looking at, where they are looking at argumentation software, categorising information so people can find it, sorting it, and so forth. And finally, just a very quick point that we think there's a... We even sort of reprimand ourselves. There's a tendency to focus on the big issues, the human rights issues, with all respect, with the clean feed. And whenever we think of public consultation, there tends to be a focus on big, big issues. What we did find, sitting quietly in the background when we went and interviewed agencies, is that many, many communities of practice and communities of interest were quietly going their way and having wonderful engagement. Things like the Australian Museum, War Memorial, Australians who go to Anzac Cove and want to comment on it and talk about it online and the protection of the site. And we find that there's a tendency perhaps to overlook some of these day-to-day very important consultations within communities of interest and communities of practice, and we're focusing on these big sort of high-profile issues. That's a very quick overview. The research is continuing. We're pleased that we've got an extension because you may have heard recently Kate Lundy launched an initiative, but most importantly, the federal government just announced the establishment of an Australian Government 2.0 task force. And it's going to look at the next stage of how our government in this country tries to use online tools to expand and improve consultation. Very pleased to say that the chair of that, Nicholas Gruen, has asked for our report, and he has it. He hasn't said he likes it yet, but it has gone forward, so it's sort of fun to do research that someone's looking at, and we look forward to doing more of it. Thank you.
I have two questions related to your topic. What is, you know, as you mentioned that in United Kingdom there's extensive research. I think I found in last year Aaron Davis' one research. He looked at how politicians is using the online or e-governance, and he found that most of the time politicians are using for their own purpose. That means, you know, public relations purpose. It's not very, you know, in a sense he was trying to say it's not very useful, yet it's not very useful for the public. That's one. My question is whether you are looking at, you know, how Australia is, it is true that Australia just recently started, but did you find any trend like UK in Australia, number one? Number two is, I found recently George Monbiot, you know, he got a blog, and he was talking about the idea of astroturfing, that, you know, you said that who is doing the comment. When we started
astroturfing, yes. Astroturfing, yeah.
Yeah. So are you going to look at the astroturfing as well?
We haven't specifically. All we've known, we didn't even find examples, but we were told by some people that they were concerned, a lot of the public servants, that certain interest groups were getting into these forums and just getting all their members and GetUp, I think, did it at one stage, didn't they, Vicky? And said, here, mail this one, and there were sort of blocks of people coming in. And it's a question, it's a difficult one, because if those people are doing it, maybe it is their genuinely held views, but to what extent are they, you know, a bit like the direct letter writing campaigns that organisations used to do to ministers, you know, they were practically template form letters. So there is an element of that, and it is a concern, but we don't know how widespread. Your first part of your question, politicians, we only looked at sites that primary purpose was listening, not talking. And that's the big issue in all this. It's about listening. And that's a difficult sounds simple, but a very difficult concept for most of us to get our head around, because there's a tendency for the other. And just jumping back to finish that question, in the election, e-electioneering, we did a study previously, and we looked at the sites of 200 and something politicians and political parties. Almost all of the politicians had comments turned off on their sites. Very, very few, in fact, all but one did not accept negative comments, criticisms. They were PR vehicles. So that answers your question there. It was quite blatant during the election. But in this particular case, we chose sites that the primary purpose, at least the stated purpose, was to invite people to talk. So they were meant to be listening and responding and saying thank you and inviting comments. The biggest concern I've got is that now that they've got it, I can't see much evidence of what they're going to do with it, because they don't even have the tools or the resources to wade through it and try and hear what people have said, let alone connect it and link it back into the policy-making process. But I think they're trying, and I think it's a learning process.
My question was probably similar, and that is, are you exploring any systematic approach or response by civil society organisations to this, either directly with government about how they're going to manage it, or with each other? Or, I mean, you've mentioned that there's a sense of perhaps hijacking, but in a more serious e-democracy way, is there any sort of dialogue between civil society organisations like GetUp? But I mean, there are hundreds of them.
Exactly. I think it's a really, really good point. No, we're not looking at that at the moment. What we've tended to do, and we're not looking at citizens' experience either, which is another whole area of research that I'd love to go and ask citizens who have participated, what did they get out of it? Because that's a good question. We've simply tried to understand, looking at what is the government actually doing, why are they doing it, how are they going about it, how are they choosing platforms. There is an interesting question raised, though, that they are seen to be going to the mass audience, and we can't see evidence they've got a policy to engage with certain groups. And most of the researchers in this field seem to suggest that there's got to be a hybrid model. There should be the open sites for citizens, but there's also got to be engagement with representative organisations. There's got to equally a hybrid model of some government-run sites versus government listening to other sites that are run autonomously. And I think if I had to take a punt, I would say you'll see a hybrid model evolve out of this. There's no one answer, no one thing fits all.
Any other questions at this point?
Is there evidence that the government's taken notice? I mean, are they instigating policy changes as a result of Mums UK or as a result of any of these sites?
There's little bits filtering through in the UK, and again, my last point, it's the best evidence seems to be at the micro level. Fix our street, things like that, fix the pothole on the street. That there is evidence down there that people are posting a photograph of a broken phone booth or a hole in the street and the council's getting it fixed. At the national and federal levels, we're not seeing the evidence. The gauge would be to see policy changing as a result of this. At the moment, the links between the consultation sites and policy making are fairly tenuous, because in some of these sites they're run by IT and communications people, and the policy makers aren't involved. Now, if the policy makers aren't involved from day one, where's going to be the linkage to take it forward? But equally, I'd have to say, it was an anecdotal observation, but I think Vicky would agree, there's a lot of goodwill. I think a lot of these are not people unintentionally not doing it, it's just happening so fast. The minister says build a blog, and they are running the public servants. And what we found is a lot of these things they just hadn't got time to work on. And would you agree, Vicky, there is a lot of genuine goodwill.
They do really want to. The people that I spoke to certainly want to get engaged, but there's a great level of fear, you know, can I actually do something?
There's institutional...
They've always wanted to consult.
Yes.
Is this an answer to consulting as opposed to actually, you know, it's that rhetoric of consultation without really having effective change. I mean, we all know that aspect of government.
And that's going to be a great big pit in the pathway. But again, we don't have the answer because it's early days. This is all very early days. It was refreshing to see a degree of genuine interest in trying to open the doors of democracy, because the tendency for public service is to talk to the usual political actors and leave it at that, you know, and the deal's done behind the back room. I worked in Canberra 5 or 6 years doing it, so, you know, it's a lot easier. Democracy's a lot easier when you don't get too many people involved.
we have to move on. One the last quick question.
I was just thinking e-democracy. Is there a concern at all that there are, you know, sectors of the community that just can't access this or not able to?
Of course, digital divide is...
democracy, but...
Yeah. In the sort of whole, the theoretical framings, digital divide is an ongoing concern, remote communities, people with disabilities as well, as all sorts of concerns. I think anyone who's looking at this is not looking at this, I don't believe, as a replacement. It's incremental. It will always be only an incremental issue, but certainly I would think if you're at Broken Hill and you're in town and there is broadband, it's a lot easier to participate online, because if you live at I was born and raised in the bush, and it's damned hard to participate in any form of politics, because the local country party is not listening and their offices are shut down, so where do you go? So it's got to be have a positive element, but if you saw it as a replacement for other forms of participation, that would be, I think, a grave mistake.
Thank you.